You're listening to the Youth Crit Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at DecibelUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at DecibelUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
Welcome to the Youth Critic Podcast. I am your host, Kale Smith, and with me today is...
Brandon.
And this week we are going to be doing another retrospective. Yes, another retrospective. I know they're getting old, believe me, but we don't have anything else to talk about. So this week we are going to be talking about 1976, and you're wondering probably why we're talking about a year in specifically. Well, Brandon, do you want to... explain why we're talking about 1976?
Well, the simple way is it's a great year for movies. Some people say four great movies. I would say three, maybe four, yeah. But it was a very important year for movies, though, because it was during the, some people call it the Golden Age of Hollywood.
Golden Age of cinema.
Yeah, it's the Golden Age is way before that of Hollywood. They also call it the, what else do they call it? The new...
The
Renaissance,
I think it's called the New American Wave of Cinema.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, it's 67 to 80, and it was 76 could be called like
the center climax.
Point. The climax. It was the center point. It was like the last great year for movies, really, in that decade, the 70s.
Well, mostly because after that, we got Star Wars, and while Star Wars is a great movie, there wasn't like a whole succession of great movies afterwards, and then... Each year it kind of declined in quality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But
that's subjective, but I think a lot of people would agree that 76 and 75 are much better years for movies than 77 and 78. So,
and also we're talking about this year because, not only is it the 40th anniversary of a lot of these movies, but also it's been a kind of a crappy year at the movies.
It has been. Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yeah.
It's been kind of a crappy year, and it's interesting to talk about something 40 years ago. And we're going to, and Brandon and I are going to sound like a bunch of old hermits by the end of this.
Well, we weren't born back then. I mean, that's kind of funny that we're discussing it like we.
I know, but it's so interesting that, you know, we're like super young people or subjectively young people, and we're talking about the good old days already.
Yeah.
And. So let's kind of dive into this. Let's start with All the President's Men.
Cool. So you saw it last night?
I saw it last night. I got a HBO subscription, so yes, I'm going to be checking out Westworld.
Awesome, yeah.
I know. I've been wanting to see it. I've been wanting to see it for the last, like, 3 months.
Yeah.
But school, of course, you know, school really takes up most of my TV watching time, so... now that I have an HBO subscription, I will be watching the show over the break.
Cool.
And catching up on all things Westworld, since I am the one of the biggest sci-fi nerds.
Hmm.
But anyway, I saw it, and it took me like 4 hours to watch it because my internet was so shitty. And also, there was like a party going on at my house. There was like a 48-hour party. My sister likes to throw parties at the house, so... so, of course, the internet just wears down. And, of course, it kept varying in quality. It went from 144p to what standard definition, 420.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was not a great experience, but I still think it's a great movie.
Cool.
Especially Hal Holbrook's character, Deep Throat. I love that character so much. And he's been imitated a lot, but Hal Holbrook just is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, what's interesting is that I liked it too quite a bit. I haven't seen it in several years, so I'm not as familiar with it as the other ones. But what's interesting is that it took place, it was made only a year and a half after the actual Watergate scandal. It was being made a year and a half later.
I think the movie says the Watergate scandal happened in 72.
Well, the hearings, though, were 74. Scandal itself, it happened in the election of 72 with Nixon's reelection.
Right.
But the actual controversy was 74 when the public learned about it. So in terms of making a movie that short after and, like, that immediate, I think it handled it pretty well. Like,
it's a lot better than an Oliver Stone movie.
Exactly. Yeah, it's much better. Well, I would say Oliver Stone makes some pretty great movies, but his movies are more about the excitement behind it, or, like, the not glamorizes.
Capitalize it.
Yeah, exactly. He's more about the controversy, and All the President's mm-hmm. Men's more about the journalism. Like,
right.
Spotlight, you know?
Yeah, like last year's Spotlight,
exactly.
Which
yeah.
was probably one of my favorite movies of last year.
Yeah, and a good comparison would be if they made Spotlight in 2003 rather than 2015, you know?
Right.
And that'd be hard to do. I think that's pretty impressive that All the President's Men could make a movie that immediate.
And know all the facts.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
everything about it. Yeah. I mean, so let me ask you this, because I'm not 100% sure. I didn't research on the movie at all. Usually after every biopic I try to do a little bit of research.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know if it really was the Washington Post and it was two writers? Do you know yeah. how true the story actually is?
It's pretty accurate. I mean, the scandal would have gotten revealed eventually, but it may have been a decade later, so to speak. It's hard to say when it would have gotten like out in the newspapers.
I don't think it would have ever gotten out.
Yeah, I
think, for this.
Yeah, because we had the Nixon tapes. I mean, he had them, you know, so we would have found out eventually through those tapes, possibly.
Probably,
but
yes.
they were the ones who sped up the process, and they were the ones who uncovered the actual, like, it went up all the way to the White House. And one of the misconceptions is that Nixon didn't order Watergate to happen. He didn't give out the orders. He just covered it up. So that's something that people forget, too. It's more about the cover-up of it and the fact he paid off Howard Hunt, the guy who was in charge of the Watergate break-in.
Okay.
So it's
well, the movie implies that it went all the way up to Nixon.
Yeah, he was the one covering it up. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So it wasn't just he covered it up. He was also it wasn't that he was the one that was like sending people out. He was just covering up.
Yeah, yeah. It was the committee to reelect the president. That was Howard Hunt. He was the one who ordered the Watergate break-in.
Okay.
And Nixon found out about it, and he was a very paranoid kind of president. And I actually like Nixon, his first term. His second term was a disaster, obviously. But he isn't such a completely a bad guy. But yeah, he was very paranoid about this kind of stuff, and he tried to cover it up. So that's yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not to get too far into making this a historical
yeah,
history episode,
yeah.
But yeah, I do agree. I mean, the first term he brought China in, like he started
yeah.
talking with China
yeah,
to
open trade
and. Trying to, you know, make our relations with China, who were communists at the time, making it a better, trying to make the situation between us and China better.
Yeah. Started the EPA too. Mm-hmm. Brought down the voting age or legally to 18 instead of 21.
So right.
Pretty cool.
So, yeah. And then, of course, you know, you were right. The second half was completely disastrous.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And Gerald Ford, I think made a very bad political mistake.
There's two sides to it. Yeah, I think there was a pardoning him quick, sped up the process of America kind of like healing from that. But it was a move that was kind of shady to some people because
it is very
of what
shady.
Nixon did. So it's kind of a mixed bag, you know? Yeah. So.
It is. Well, it's very shady, but also I think for Ford, it really put an end to his career.
I think
that was a decision. I mean, he probably had good intentions behind
yeah.
it, but I think it was politically the wrong move.
Yeah. I mean, that was that in the debate in 76 that ended his bid for president. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's politics, though. That's,
yeah.
It's my field, actually. That's my specialty.
Yeah, you're the one graduating
yeah.
for this.
Yeah. But movies, though. Yeah. All the President's Men.
Yeah. I like the movie a lot. I love, again, it's not, I love how this movie is not necessarily like an over the top, like journalist. Like there's not like, you know, rampant editing and
yeah, yeah.
over the top acting
right.
and people screaming. I mean, it's fucking journalism, not
yeah.
the fucking news.
Yeah.
If
I remember right, what I like about it is that if I'm remembering correctly, Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman kind of have like a good cop, bad cop kind of thing going on early on in the movie. Like Dustin Hoffman.
A couple times, yes.
Yeah, Robert Redford's kind of the new guy, right? He plays Woodward. Is that?
No. Dustin Hoffman's the new guy. Dustin Hoffman is the guy who's only been on for 9 months.
Oh, okay. I thought it was the reverse of that. Okay. See, it's been a while since I saw
him. And Redford is the one that's been a while. And at first, they don't really care for each other because
that's what I remembered, yeah.
Hoffman kind of took his story and revised it without his permission.
That's right, yeah.
I
like the two of them, the chemistry between the two, Redford and Hoffman.
Yeah, they worked really well together. And yeah. Didn't they work together again for...
They did. What movie?
Marathon Man?
No, Redford wasn't a Marathon Man. That was Roy Scheider in that.
Oh, okay.
That came out that same year.
It wasn't 3 Days of the Condor, right?
I haven't seen that. It doesn't sound right. It was that bad movie. It came out in the 80s. It was that really... what was it called? I'll have to look it up.
Tootsie?
No, that was a good movie. We'll keep discussing.
Okay.
I'll look it up. Yeah.
But overall, I enjoyed the chemistry. I love the actors. I thought... I loved how the movie portrayed journalism. It's,
yeah.
And, but also I love the whole like thriller aspect, and it felt, and you did feel the entire movie that, you know, of being watched. I mean, mm-hmm. If you look closely behind certain shots, it almost looks, they're not completely in focus, but it looks like there are people walking in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Like the newsroom, but like the actual
The Washington Post, you mean?
Right. Well, yeah. Not only that, but when they're interviewing people, sometimes it looks like people are walking behind. I mean, maybe I was envisioning things or maybe I was like seeing different things, but I like the attention to detail of making you feel like this was real. And by adding even more of the tension of at the end, they're being watched, and having that in there is a really great, I mean, that's a really terrifying thing of everyone being watched.
Yeah. Yeah. As a side note, it was the movie I was thinking of was called Ishtar, but that's not Robert Redford. That's Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
So not different movie, but so anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say,
I couldn't think of it. Yeah.
But also the only issue I have with the movie is it kind of has the same problem that we had on Death of A, where we kind of just, you know, I know you guys have probably not seen Death of A. I don't think anyone has.
Everybody's
ever
not seen it, except for 10 of us.
Yeah. But it's very similar to the end of Death of A, where we kind of just end abruptly at the climax, mm-hmm. and then just have a scroll crawl basically explaining everything
that happened.
Yeah,
that last scene is pretty cool. Yeah, the way the text comes up while mm-hmm. they're typing the story. Yeah.
Right.
It's a good scene. Yeah.
So we homaged Death of A, even though I don't think any of us realized it. Or we
yeah,
homaged,
I didn't do the text
in
Death of A. I thought that was Chris, wasn't it? Yeah.
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 Maybe he saw all the President's Men, didn't tell us about it.
Yeah.
Chris, if you could hear us, let us know. Let us know if you watched All the President's Men while you were editing our movie. So anyway.
Anything else to say about All the President's Men?
It's a really good movie. I didn't really care for the ending because I thought, I mean, look, it's great that they didn't end with like a prosecution or a huge court battle with everyone screaming at each other. But I felt like they kind of just skipped to the end once we found out that everyone's being watched, when I really wanted to see more of the aftermath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And while I realize it was made in the midst of the aftermath, I would have loved to have seen more of how people were dealing with the world changing. Because that was the thing with Spotlight, is it ends with everybody kind of, you know, you see all the people outside of the Spotlight group reeling in from the discovery of the Catholic priests.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you want a good follow-up movie, you could watch Frost Nixon. That's about in 77, he did the interviews with Frost. I can't remember his first name, but the guy.
David Frost, I think.
Sounds right, yeah, David Frost. Frank Langella plays Nixon. Doesn't look like Nixon, but does a good job, though. He's a good. I think Anthony Hopkins is the best Nixon from Oliver Stone's movie, but he's, they're both good, though.
It's tough to do a really good Nixon because Nixon is his own thing. Like, you can't, like, you either are impersonating him or
exactly,
you kind of take the Steve Jobs route where you have an actor that embodies his characteristics.
Yeah, because if you do get someone who looks exactly like him, it could be a stereotype, like not a stereotype, but it could be like a, what's the right word? Like just a very, a parody, you know?
Right.
Like, and so that's a risk too. And I think they, both Hopkins and Langella had did a good job of like doing the characteristics of Nixon and like the body language, you know?
So. Right. So let's move to, let's move towards Network.
Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah.
This is probably
one of my all-time favorites. Yeah.
I'm still thinking about it. It's probably my favorite on the four movies we're mentioning.
Yeah.
Network. I love this movie. This is, it is so scary, relevant now.
Yeah. We watched it on the way to Boston, right? We
2 years ago, yes.
Yeah, because I've seen it like four or five times, but I remember I brought it with me and we watched. I fell asleep in the car, but...
Well, I was watching the movie and I truly loved it. I thought it was so compelling.
What I like to say about 76 and the two movies, Network and Taxi Driver, which are my favorites of that year, is that Taxi Driver, they're both dystopias. Taxi Driver is a dystopia of New York City of what it was, and Network is a dystopia of what the television industry became, like the cable news.
Right.
And it
we start utopian and then we go into much more horrible territory.
I wouldn't even say utopian. I mean, I would say that the television back then, before that, like
I mean,
70s?
To normal. Like, to normal.
Yeah, normal. The Walter Cronkite kind of television.
Right.
Where it was trusted, you know, and, like, they even mentioned...
And where it wasn't news commentary.
Yeah, they mentioned CBS, the guy from, oh, what's the guy who broke Red Scare. Anyway, it's they mentioned him in the movie, but a great, you know, television network.
Right. And I love, is it Peter Finch?
Well, that's the actor. Yeah, I'm saying the guy, Murrow, Edward R. Murrow. They mentioned him in the movie.
I was talking about the actor. Like,
yeah.
I loved his performance.
Yeah.
And what I loved about the movie is how everyone becomes fascinated by this idea that, oh my God, we finally have our pot of money, where we finally have someone who can comment on the news and garner people's attention and viewership.
Yeah.
We can make a talk show out of this. And I love how everyone is just fantasize about it, but in the end, they all kind of feel terrible and bad and want it executed out of society.
Yeah, and not to get too political again, I mean, but this does link very well.
Almost all these movies are political.
They are actually.
Even Rocky, there's an undertone political.
Yeah.
Underlining political theme there.
Not to get too political, but this does trace very well to the rise of Trump, how he became. I mean, he's a reality TV star, The Apprentice. I mean,
right.
And in 76, people forget this, but we had just experienced Vietnam and Watergate. I mean, people were depressed and angry and pessimistic. And what
and
Network
I think,
does.
The stock market was also not doing well.
Yeah, it was stagflation. It was just the beginning of that. It was during Carter's term that happened. But, well, it was really during Gerald Ford's and Carter. But anyway.
Okay.
The economy's bad. And what Faye Dunaway does, her character in that, who's a great villain, one of my all-time favorite villains in movies.
Well, she's
Faye
not the only villain. I think Ned Beatty.
Yeah, I would say. Well, he's a smaller villain. He plays a smaller role. But
right.
She's very good in this movie. It's one of my all-time favorite performances, her and Peter Finch. And what she does is she takes advantage of that. She profits off of people's pessimism, basically. That's the best way to put it.
Frustration.
They want to hear someone complain. They want to hear someone preach, basically. The Howard Beale show is what... You could compare it to the Fox News and MSNBC shows today, and they're both very partisan. I mean, I won't pick one. You know, I mean,
right? I mean, it's so scary accurate because that's literally the world today. That's how we get our news. Everyone is polarizing into their own situation. That's how we get our news. You either get it from a Republican news network or Fox.
Yeah.
You get it from a Democrat from CNN, or you get a Libertarian.
Yeah.
Or a Libertarian from MSNBC.
Yeah. Well, MSNBC is liberal, I would say. That CNN's more leans left. MSNBC is definitely not Libertarian. That's a whole different – yeah, that's not really a – but the only really news program that's really, like, bipartisan – maybe BBC World News. I don't know. It's hard to find. I mean, it's at this point. NBC News with Lester Holt's pretty. It's a 30-minute.
According to statistics, I think it was the Wall Street Journal that is the most like bipartisan.
They kind of lean right. I don't know. It's hard to find a good bipartisan.
Well, it's hard because because of because of the now the availability to make TV shows and have all this access and to reach people, everything's become polarized.
And beyond
it's harder
politics.
To find, you know, it's harder to go through all that noise to find a bipartisan voice.
Yeah. And beyond politics, what is also important is that they don't really mention the 24-hour news cycle in this movie because it hasn't didn't happen yet. And because Ted Turner came around in the 80s and he was the first one to really kind of invent that, you know.
Right. But the movie's still relevant.
It's still relevant. Yeah. Because the reason why it's relevant is because she mixes news and entertainment together. That's what it's about, is making a profit through mixing the two and trying to get people to watch their show more. Because I think the company is called, is it UBS? United Broadcasting? It's like a fictional.
I think so.
It's a fourth channel back then there were three, which is hard to believe. But it's a fourth channel, and they're the weakest. They're the ones who are making the least amount of money. So
right.
There you go.
And even worse is, you know, we're taking advantage of someone's mental breakdown.
Someone who's losing
his mind.
The exploitation of, yeah, exactly. And look at reality TV today. I mean, a lot of people in reality TV, the stars, are dysfunctional. I mean, that's why we watch it, you know?
Some of them are even created that way. Like, they're created to be more dysfunctional than others.
Yeah, I mean,
reality TV is fake, people. Reality TV is completely fake.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm an editor. I've edited movies before, or short films. It's all edited. I mean, they pick the scenes that are the most extreme and the most
glamorous.
Sometimes
they'll even write the scenario.
Yeah, and from an editing standpoint, that's how they make the show. I mean, it's all editing. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and Sidney Lumet, who is, what, in his 50s at the time? Or
sounds right, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, just still on the top of his game. I mean, he did some bad stuff like The Wiz.
But
I mean, still, he was on the top of his game when he made this movie, and everyone's giving a great performance.
Yeah, who wrote it? It was Peter Chavesky. I can't remember his name. Sounds wrong.
You would know it better than me.
I want to say Peter Chavesky, but I think I'm misspelling that last name or saying it wrong. Let me look it up real quick. Great screenplay, though. Amazing. I mean.
Did it even win the screenplay award?
Oh, it won. Yeah, it did win best screenplay. Yeah.
Because I was like, I know Rocky didn't. I know for a fact it didn't win the screenwriting award or screenplay.
That's it, yeah. No, but not Peter, Patty. That's right. Patty Chavesky.
Okay.
Yeah. Great screenplay. One of my favorites. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I think we're.
So we need to kind of speed through this. Rocky. Yeah. We just talked about Rocky, so I just talked about it a couple weeks ago. So Brandon, what are your thoughts on Rocky?
Well, okay, I've been harsh against it. I mean, the thing is, it's not a bad movie, but it's not really good either. That's the best way I can explain it.
I've been debatably harsh on Rocky too.
Yeah, because if it hadn't won Best Picture, I honestly would have seen it and thought, you know, okay, that's an okay movie.
I kind of call it the Forrest Gump of 1976.
Yeah, well, although Forrest Gump is a good movie, though. I like that quite a bit. It's just...
Well, I mean that because it's a movie that is good, but it shouldn't have won Best Picture.
Yeah, and I don't want to judge a movie based on that, but I think Rocky is just a really average movie. And I think that because it was uplifting, I guess, people would like it because of that. I don't know. I it's funny because I'm not a big fan of sports movies. I mean, I was joking that, I mean, I saw Raging Bull first and I can't watch Rocky after that because of the, you know, it's just so much more interesting to me personally. But to be fair though, with the sports movies, I think that Rocky would have been better if there would have been more comedy in it, more of a sense of humor. Or if, let's say, Taylor Shire's character, if she was written differently to where she was always like turning him down, you know, like if it was like he was trying to get the girl and she was, you know, that would have been more of like a, not a romantic comedy, that would have been bad, but more of that kind of, more of those elements in the movie, because it felt very bland to me when I first saw it. I mean, what do you think? It's,
well, not to rehash what I said 2 weeks ago, my problem with the movie is that the film is better when you're watching it in a sequence of clips on YouTube, like when you're watching the montage on YouTube, when you're watching the final scene or final fight scene, or the first love scene between Rocky and Adrian. When you're watching those, they're really great as individual scenes, but they're all awkwardly shoved into the movie for me. Like, that's really my problem with the movie, is everything is just awkwardly just shoved in there. Like, but the scene we have before the big montage scene is where Rocky meets, like, his, like, medic that he's going to run in. He's going to have beside him and Mickey in the fight. And then it cuts to the montage.
Yeah.
Like, there's no build-up or lead-up to anything that's happening. Even the fight scene is kind of like, it just kind of ends abruptly.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And then, and even make it worse, they throw in Adrian in there at the last minute to make everyone just feel happy and uplifted.
And, like, he doesn't care about the fight, which, okay, I guess that's uplifting that he cares about her more.
Well, I think he realized that there's no way he could win.
Yeah, just, but there's a whole build-up to that fight, and it's like, and the fight's not really filmed very in any kind of unique way too, if I remember right. It was very, for the time, it was very bland, just the way.
I mean, they did the best they could for a low budget movie, but
yeah.
The more I think about Rocky and then think what John Carpenter did 2 years later with Halloween, which I know you didn't like, but that movie is way more well put together, and it costs like a fraction of what Rocky cost.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, John Avildsen, you have no idea how to make this fucking movie.
Yeah, it hasn't aged as well.
And the script is not that great.
Like, yeah, it's not, yeah.
Well, it's not structurally well-paced. Like, it's not well, like, the narrative, like, it's not building to anything. Like, that's my problem with Rocky.
Yeah. And comparing the two other boxing movies that are kind of famous and well-known, like Raging Bull and Million Dollar Baby, those two just have so much more of a point to them. I mean, like, that, not to be... put it simply, but I don't see the point of Rocky at the very end. I mean, the way the last third of the movie goes, you know, like, it's just
right. And really just to not bash on Rocky, my favorite moment in the movie is, or the favorite theme that I like about the movie is how Apollo Creed is representing of, he's essentially, you know, manufactured patriotism. Or corporate patriotism, where he's basically the image of America. Like, he wears the George Washington wig. He wears the American flag shorts. He, you know, his banner has the American flag in it. I mean, he is painted to be the all-American good hero. But the problem with Apollo Creed, and the reason why he will never be an underdog, is because he's not the guy on the street.
Yeah.
He's not... the everyday man, and that's why Rocky has always been a relatable character, and the reason why people like him is because at the end of the day, Rocky is the guy on the street who went up against a system that really was, despite how you debate it, they were gonna essentially play down the poor people again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he is a likable character, without a doubt. I mean, that Rocky Balboa. Mm-hmm. But I need more than that, you know? It's not, like, underdog movies, you need something more than just an underdog. It's the same reason why I didn't like Slumdog Millionaire.
Right.
It's just, because those two movies, it's about the game. You know, it's not about, instead of focusing on their lives, and Rocky does, you know, in to its defense, but I just didn't find it that interesting, you know? I mean... I will
say, though, 2, 3, 4, Rocky Balboa and Creed are better movies than Rocky.
2, 3, and 4 are? Really?
2, 3, and 4.
Okay, well, I'll check out Creed maybe sometime. But
I mean, the sequels got better, like, for me. Like, the Rocky franchise is so interesting because I like the sequels way more.
Mm-hmm.
Other than Rocky V, I like the sequels way more than the actual original movie.
Yeah.
It's a rare case. But Rocky was, for me, like, I would like the sequels more. So let's move on to your favorite of all,
I'm torn between that and Network. Yeah, I've always been going back and forth. Yeah. It's a great movie, though. Yeah.
I enjoy this movie. I mean, well, I should take that back. It's not an enjoyable movie. I admire it a lot.
Yeah, it's enjoyable in a certain kind of way. It's a very... You can't just sit down and watch it. You have to actually, like, I mean,
you get something out of it.
You have to be in the mood for it, yeah. Or be ready for it.
Yeah, and it's a lot to take in the first viewing.
It is, yeah. I saw it when I was, like, 15, which I probably shouldn't have. But I was, like, 14 or 15, I think, when I first saw it. And, yeah, I wasn't aware of how dark New York City really was back then when I first saw it. And seeing movies back then that take place in New York City, like French Connection,
right.
You get to see that that kind of environment. But yeah, it's a dark place. I mean, it's especially,
yeah,
I mean, that decade before then.
Right.
And I think that this kind of movie couldn't be made today in a lot of ways. I mean, it could have been.
It could be made independently.
Independently, but I think they would make it pretentious. And I know that's like, it sounds bad to say, but I think it would be very difficult to do in the same kind of stark kind of realism that
Scorsese brought to it. So like Alejandro González Iñárritu?
Yeah, and I like some of his movies. Yeah, exactly. But it would have been more, it's hard to explain, but the way they present his character, I mean, you don't like him, but you understand how miserable he is, you know?
Right.
I mean, he's the villain in the movie. I mean, that's without
yeah,
doubt.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right, he's the bad guy, but he's the protagonist.
He is the protagonist, technically. Yeah, that's true. And Scorsese, that's what he's all been about. Like, Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Goodfellas. He takes a very unlikable character, but you understand their misery and, like, how they actually, the environment they were in and how that led to them becoming a bad person, basically. That's the best way to explain it. I mean,
right.
And Taxi Driver was his first movie. No, Mean Streets was kind of like that. It was his first one to kind of take on that, you know, of how someone could become like this.
We're fine.
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, you like the movie? Yeah.
I definitely like the movie. It's one of my favorite Scorsese movies so far. Mm-hmm. I've been kind of watching them watching another one every now and then, because you can only take Scorsese in doses.
Yeah. You can't marathon it. Yeah.
Yeah, you can't just binge.
I mean, he's my favorite director, but you can't marathon Scorsese movies. I mean,
Goodfellas is still my favorite Scorsese movie, but this is probably my second favorite, and then Departed. Because what I love about the character, I just love that it's an examination on a character, again, going insane, but you see why he's going insane. He's going against a system that's really taken away the basics needs you need as a functioning person.
Yeah.
Like, he wants to have a girlfriend, but because he's so kind of socially awkward and doesn't realize that. I think they were just watching a French movie that had a lot of nudity.
Well, no, it was more than that.
Or it was a porn.
It was a full-on exploitation movie. I mean, not necessarily a porn. Well, was it a porn? I mean, it was pretty intense.
I've heard it was a porn, but I thought it was like a French nude movie.
Well, there were some of those back then. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure what kind of movie it was, but the point, it was a bad movie. It was, yeah, not the kind of movie you take your girlfriend that
for the first time
on a first date. Yeah, not only that. Yeah, if you look at the date they were on before then, when they're just having lunch, I mean, he is like, he's trying to be charming.
Yeah.
I mean, he's trying his best.
He's trying, and
he has the best intentions, but he's just not, like,
he's a little too awkward.
Yeah.
And for her, well, he's kind of, I would just say he's out of his league.
He is, yeah.
With her. And so, of course, this leads, you know, more down towards, you know, a person, but in the end...
Oh, the ending is genius. It's great.
He celebrated.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And the question is, was he... I mean, he tries almost to assassinate the senator who was running for president.
But because he shoots down...
Yeah.
A pimp and a couple other...
Harvey Keitel. Yeah.
Right.
The question is, was he doing it to be a hero? Was he doing it because it was the right thing? Or was he just letting his aggression take control of him? I mean, and that's the question at the end, because he is celebrated as a hero. But there's that very brief moment where he readjusts the mirror in the taxi, the cab, and it does this weird like kind of editing trick where it makes you think, is he still crazy? Will he go off again at some point? Is this just another like,
right?
Just a release, and he'll just build up again, you know? And it makes you wonder. Yeah, it's a tough movie. Yeah.
It's a fascinating film, and actually it is very relevant today. I mean,
yeah.
Some people would actually celebrate that kind of person.
They would, yeah.
And it's not a side know
note.
It.
Yeah, not know it, yeah. And there's a side note, too. I think his name was John Hickley Jr. No, not Jr. It was John
the
Hickley.
The person who tried to assassinate Reagan?
Yeah, was it a Jr.? I can't remember his
I don't
exact
know.
Name. But the guy that tried to assassinate Reagan was inspired by the movie, and he was trying to impress Jodie Foster. And, I mean, that was his reason, apparently. I mean, that he was actually released last year. This year.
And really, I mean, the movie is an examination on that kind of person.
Exactly, yeah. The kind of person that would assassinate a politician or just go off on a rampage. I mean, that's...
And I hope it makes people... And I hope that kind of makes people realize what the real intention of that movie was.
Exactly, yeah.
Was to point out, you know, why are we celebrating these kind of people? When...
Yeah.
You know, is it just because they did a good thing, or is it because they were... or, you know, or is it because they were just lashing out on society?
Yeah. Well, in order to prevent it from happening, you need to understand where they're coming from. You need to understand why they're so
dysfunctional.
Dysfunctional, yeah. And that's, yeah. I think actually I was watching special features of that movie, and the guy who wrote it,
Paul Schrader.
That sounds right. Paul, I can't remember. Yeah, Paul Schrader.
I think that's right, because he also wrote Raging Bull.
He did, yeah. Great screenwriter. He said that a year later after it came out, he actually, a real taxi driver in real life, came to him and said that that movie pretty much explained his whole, like, environment of what he lived in. He wasn't from New York City. He was from a larger city. He actually came up to him and said, you nailed it. I mean, that was, like, what I experienced on a daily basis. That kind of, the people that he was driving around New York City and just that kind
of really cool
negative environment.
That's really, really cool.
That's amazing. From a screenwriting perspective, that's like amazing to have that happen to you. I mean, that's
cool. So to wrap this up, let's kind of talk about the end of the golden age of cinema. And we'll talk, and I'm sure we'll do another episode explaining the full, not golden age of cinema. I don't know when, but it will be sooner rather than later, because I actually find the 70s quite interesting. But Brandon, why do you think the golden age ended? And then I'll give you my take.
Well, a lot of people blame Jaws and Star Wars, and I don't blame those two movies, actually. Because
I don't either.
Here's the reason why. Before Jaws, there wasn't a summer blockbuster per se, but there were blockbusters though.
Right. I mean, we had the Sting, the Godfather movies,
The Exorcist. Yeah, they all made a lot of money. And they were
The Sound of Music.
Yeah. And those three movies, not The Sound of Music, but in the 70s, those three were all dramas. Not The Sting, but they were all like slow-paced movies, but they were for a mass audience, you know?
Right.
They weren't pretentious. That's the best way to put it. They weren't art films, you know?
They were for the common people.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's one way to say it. Yeah, they were. And
Brandon, I'm not trying to insult them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is what it is. I mean, that's they were for people who aren't into movies as much as we are. That's the best way to put it.
Right.
Yeah. So there were blockbusters. The problem with what happened is that it became about sequels. It became like, and there were sequels before then too, but it became more about like what was special effects and sequels and
what was drawing people to the theater.
And the studios just didn't want to take any more risks. And I think that's sad because the two, Jaws and Star Wars, were both very high risk kind of movies. I mean, they were high budget. Well, sort of. They weren't high budget as terms of the day. But they were two concepts that
I
could have been.
I think Jaws probably was more high cost because it went over budget. But
it did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they Star Wars, not really.
They could have been B movies. That's the best way to put it.
Right.
They could have been failures. You know, that's. So they just, I think in the 80s, and there were great movies in the 80s. I know I always make fun of the 80s, but there were some good ones here and there. But it just, overall, the movies were not as. You didn't have the same kind of dramas as you had in the 70s. Movies about that kind of, you know, that captured the moment, you know?
Right.
So
my take on the reason why it ended is more because you're right, it's not Jaws or Star Wars, even though it was kind of, they planted the seeds of what we got today.
Yeah.
My problem with Jaws, or my problem with these movies, are really, you know, and really what was the downfall was the directors.
Yeah.
I think what happened was, the directors had a lot of big projects like Steven Spielberg with 1941. Can you look up the Peter Bogdanovich's movie?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I don't know. It's the one with Burt Reynolds.
Near the end of the 70s?
Near the end of the 70s. Probably was the last movie he made in the 70s. And then you had Apocalypse Now, which, I mean, yes, was a hit, but it was still like high cost and had so many problems. These movies just grew and grew and grew to the point where studios couldn't afford them anymore. And then, of course, the straw that broke the camel's back was Heaven's Gate, with Michael Cimino making probably the most expensive movie at that time of $44 million, and it shot for almost a full year. And when they got the first cut, it was United Artists got the first cut, it was 5.5 hours. The final battle was a 2-hour movie in itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just excessiveness in that movie. And when it came out, everyone was more interested in what was happening behind the scene, the drama behind the scenes, in the actual movie.
Yeah. With Bogdanovich, his best movie from the 70s probably is Last Picture Show, which I really enjoyed. He had made What's Up, Doc, Paper Moon, and Daisy Miller. I think the one, what was the one?
I think it was Paper Moon.
Was it Paper Moon?
Is Paper Moon with Burt Reynolds?
No, it was someone different than that. It was, I can't remember who's in that actually, but it was his movies after that were At Long Last Love, Nickelodeon, and Saint Jack in the 70s. And they all laughed.
At Long Last Love. I think that, okay. Can you make sure that's the one with Burt Reynolds in it?
I can check, yeah.
I know anyway. It's a musical with Burt Reynolds in it.
Ooh, doesn't sound good.
Oh, yeah. I've seen a minute of that movie.
That's it. Burt Reynolds and Cybill Shepherd. He was in Taxi Driver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, everyone was not happy with, you know, these directors. And I think after that, and also United Artists bankrupt because of Heaven's Gate, because they just spent too much money and the movie only made like $2 million back. I mean, it was a gigantic flop.
Yeah.
And after that, no studio wanted to make movies that were that big of a risk anymore.
Yeah, so the only two directors who really survived this were Scorsese, well, Spielberg mostly, and Scorsese. I mean, they were the only two that really, like, were still making movies at a high rate, you know, like, afterward. The cinema, like, because Coppola burned out.
Well, Coppola kind of climaxed after the Godfather movies.
I would say Apocalypse Now. That was his last hurrah, kind of.
Okay.
Because it was a chaotic mess of a production, but it turned out to be a very highly acclaimed movie, and I really enjoy it. I mean,
Francis Ford Coppola, till the end of the 90s, was still making movies. Like, I don't know. I don't know if they were any good.
It's not in the same league, though, as his 70s career. I mean, because the 70s movies were amazing. And Robert Altman was probably the second most prolific director of the 70s, but
he also had a flop that
he did. It was
Popeye,
yeah, which is bad. But he's a great director though, and he made a few other movies after that, like The Player is a great movie, mm-hmm. but just not the same as before.
You know? Yeah, and I mean, you can argue George Lucas, but
yeah, I mean.
I mean, George Lucas was making movies in the 90s. Unfortunately, no one really likes them now.
Yeah. Oh, did he direct movies in the 90s besides Star Wars?
No, that's what I was referring to. He was directing movies in, like, Phantom Menace. And,
oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
And the new Star Wars trilogy.
Yeah, because he never liked directing. I don't know. So I don't know why he came back to direct the prequels. I mean, he just was never a...
Actually, it was his friends told him to make the movie.
Oh, really? Is that...
He wanted Ron Howard to direct The Phantom Ooh, Menace. Yeah. And then either for Spielberg Episode 2 or Episode 3. But all of his friends told him, no, Lucas, it's your baby.
Yeah. Well, you know, George Lucas... Well,
it's
go
your
ahead.
Baby. You know, you should direct it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, George Lucas, he was a great director in the 70s, and people say now that it's all about the Star Wars, it was all about the team effort, you know, and I think that's true. But if you look at American Graffiti and THX, those are both very good movies. I mean, they were his movies. It was American Graffiti is his childhood, or when he was a teenager, you know, so I think he was a great director. It's just that the experience in Star Wars and the studio kind of just ruined him. I mean, it was on directing, you know, it was...
Yeah, and Spielberg is a better showrunner. I mean, when I mean showrunner, I mean he's a better idea person.
Producer, yeah.
Producer than, you know, an actual director.
Yeah.
So let's wrap this up.
Yeah.
Next week we will not be here. But when we do come back, we are going to talk about the movies that came out at Christmas, and then the week after that we'll talk about the 2016 as a whole. We'll talk about the best four movies of 2016.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I haven't seen very many movies, but I only have a few great movies I can think of. I mean,
yeah, it's pretty sad.
Dry year for movies.
But other than that, we're done for the year, folks. Thank you all for listening. Brandon, before we go, do you have any final words to say
about 76 or any of the stuff that?
Sure.
I gotta lean toward Network being the best of the year. Just barely over Taxi Driver.
I'll say that as well.
It's tough, but it doesn't matter in the end what the best picture should have been. But yeah, both great movies.
All right. That is it for our show this week, folks. We will be back with you in a couple weeks. Have a good... Hope you all had a great Christmas, and have a happy new year.